Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast.
Today on the Indie Opera Podcast, Noah, Brooke, Walker, and I are joined by James Marvel and Mauro Calgagno, who are working on Elio Gobbolo at Gotham Chamber Opera. Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast. This is Peter Zepp, and I am joined by a whole bunch of people today. So first, let's meet Noah Lethbridge.
Hello, you know me from the previous podcast.
Yes, he's my co-host and gad about town.
That's me.
And we also have Brooke Larimer, who you've heard before. Hello.
Hi, everyone.
Brooke's a wonderful singer who now lives in New York City. Welcome to New York.
Thank you.
And Walker Lewis, another New Yorker who is a director. Hello.
Hello there.
Okay, so now you've heard these three voices before. But we're also adding two more people today, who are special guests. One is Mauro Calgagno.
Mauro. Hello, thanks for having me.
And Mauro is a musicologist. Actually, tell us who you are.
Yes, I am a musicologist, and I teach at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, music history and theory. What else?
You're an author. You wrote a book.
Yeah, tell us about your critical edition.
Oh, okay. Well, yes, I'm an author. I just published a book on Monteverdi. It's called From Madrigal to Opera, Monteverdi's Staging of the Self, University of California Press. And yes, I'm also working at this edition of the Cavalli's opera Elio Gobbolo.
Hold on one second. Before we get too far into that, that's a street we will walk down in a few
minutes.
Sorry,
I jumped.
You jumped. And now we also are joined by James Marvel, who is also a director from Gotham Chamber Opera. Hello, James.
Hello, thank you for having me.
And James is actually quite well known. He was named Classical Singer Magazine's 2008 Stage Director of the Year, which is pretty impressive. And he's directed all over the place. He's been at Carnegie Hall. He did Carmen with Opera Africa in Johannesburg. He did stuff at Wolf Trap, Opera Boston, everywhere. And is currently working on a production of, I'm going to say it wrong, Elio Gobbolo.
Did I say it right? Elio Gobbolo. That's what this podcast is for, though. We just love pronouncing things wrong.
Yes.
That's our job.
I've decided that I'm going to allow myself to make mistakes and not edit them. So usually I warn people. I say, you know, if you say something wrong, we'll go back and fix it. But I'm not.
Nope.
No.
Against the rules.
No, you're just going to have to live with it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I like to start the show by asking people what they've seen recently or in the opera world. And let's start with our guests. Mauro, have you seen anything interesting that you want to give a shout out to?
Well, I've been at the rehearsals of Elio Gobbolo, and there was very interesting. So there are some wonderful singers, and it's a really excellent cast.
But have you seen anything outside of that lately?
Well, not that I remember in this moment, but I'm. I teach as a busy semester, so really nothing recently that I can report in this moment.
It's funny, a lot of us performers don't get a chance to see each other's work. I know that I rarely get to see
it. Or we stay home and watch South Park sometimes.
Which is also...
Yeah.
And James, how about you? Have you seen anything or mentioned
sure.
any production?
I guess most recently I saw a production of The Magic Flute at Opera Carolina, which is the same production that started off at the San Francisco Opera and has gone on to Opera Omaha and numerous other companies. And it's a very interesting concept and production. And actually, my wife was singing the role of Papagena in that particular production.
Oh, wow.
Charlotte, so that was kind of a lot of fun.
What's it like to go into a production of Magic Flute as a director? I just think of something that's such a pitfall. It's such a difficult show to direct, and you know what I mean? And what's it like to just go in there as a director?
Absolutely. I mean, I, in a sense, I always have expectations. I hope for the best. You know, I really love being in the hands of a really wonderful director, and there's always a sense in which when I know that it's going to be a really great production, I'm able to actually sit back and enjoy the thing. But you know, frequently I don't actually enjoy a lot of what I see, and so that's quite a difficult experience in terms of you know, how I like to spend my time. Mm-hmm. And but yeah, I mean, this particular production was really quite engaging from top to bottom.
So. Have you directed The Magic Flute before?
I have, actually. Yeah, I directed it down at Austin Lyric Opera in Texas about a year and a half ago. And I had done a production over in South Korea about 4 years ago, I guess.
Mm-hmm. What was their take on it?
In South Korea?
No. On the one your wife was in.
Oh, well, I mean, it was actually, the entire concept was by a Japanese designer, and it was really elaborate. It relied quite heavily on video projections, and I mean, it wasn't necessarily even recognizable as a traditional production of flute in any kind of way. But, you know, there was use of puppetry. Yeah, exactly. The Masons were not to be found in this particular production. Yeah.
So. Mm-hmm. And let's keep going around the table. Brooke, what have you seen lately?
The last thing I saw was a run of Traviata that I was in. That was also, we used projections for that production as well. It was up at Hubbard Hall Opera Theater in upstate. And it was done in a movie theater. So we had this enormous projection screen. So the director used sort of an old timey silent movie kind of backdrop for and it even like showed some projections from Camille, which was pretty cool from the silent film. It was pretty compelling, actually. And then I think previously, Peter, the opera that we went to together was the last thing I saw before that.
Yeah, we saw Mohammed Farouz's Sumida song.
Yeah.
And it was they labeled it the world premiere of an Arab composer's complete stage performance in the United States. It's never been done before, they said. And now you know Mohammed, so...
I do.
What can you tell us about him?
Well, he's a really interesting composer. We went to school together, which is kind of a funny... It was just a kind of coincidental thing. And he has always been a really exceptional composer for the voice, and has always been very theatrically oriented. We went to Boston Conservatory, and there was a really... really excellent musical theater program there. And so he, while he was there, would make use of actors and dancers and all sorts of kind of very creative stage productions that weren't necessarily opera. So he's a really interesting guy and writes really interesting music, but always, in my experience, always very singable, which is unique.
So now, how did you respond to the Sumida song? How did you feel about it?
You know, I felt like it was a really compelling piece. You know, there were some issues with the production that made it, not issues with the production, just some, like, I lost some words and diction and stuff from some of the singers, which made it a little harder to sort of follow what was going on. But I thought it was a good story for an opera. I thought that it was, I thought it was really compelling.
Yeah, the plot basically is about a mother who wants to her son to do an act of vengeance against a neighbor, and the son doesn't want to, and it's an honor killing she wants him to do, and he's not interested, and then revenge happens against him. It's very bloody.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed it. I I did have the same issues with not being able to understand some of what was going on. Like, I couldn't understand what people were saying, but I think that's partially where I was sitting. But it was also kind of bizarre. The story, you know, I have a hard time in a lot of operas where it's about honor. And there's so many about, you know, honor, oh, I'm going to lose face kind of thing. And that's what this story was. It just felt just like those old Italian things where it's, you know, honor killings. I always feel so, like, unreal. And I don't know. I just, that was the only part that I had a hard time with. There's a new opera, and it still had that same sort of weird, alienated, kill for the family.
See, you know? we always have the same, we always have the opposite reactions to things, Peter. It's so funny that we get along. It's funny that we don't punch each other out. Because I always think that honor stuff is even more fascinating in opera because it doesn't exist in Western culture so much, you know? So it's like when you see that stuff come up in operas, it's almost like an opportunity to kind of to figure out what that might have been like, or kind of situate yourself and imagine what this kind of honor value system would have resulted in. I just think that's amazing. But I can see how it could be a
I find it disturbing. I just And the thing is, this is not set though in the past. This is set in today. I mean, it's
But I think that's, you know, there are kind of honor oriented cultures or honor oriented ways of thinking are still around, and it's not a question of ignorance. And it's not a, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's this kind of constant marveling or constant enigma or something. I don't know.
It's definitely something part of being human, I guess. So anyway, that was also the last thing I saw. So you took up my time too as well. Let's see.
I continue my slump of seeing very little opera, but I saw Soldier Songs by David T. Little.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yay. How was
that? I saw that too. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't like it very much. I had a really bad experience at the theater. I don't know. I've kind of never disliked anything so much, and that's a shame because I really like David T. Little's music, at least in moments, or a lot about it I like. But I just really disliked the show and the opera and almost everything about the whole thing except for the main singer, who I thought was very skilled.
I'm gonna keep gasping.
Why are you gasping? No, you told me I was allowed to say all these things. Remember?
No, you are allowed to say it. I mean,
but the last really great thing that I saw this, I'm a teacher, so I think of years as not calendar years, but like school years. So this year, the greatest thing I saw this fall, at least, was Ivo van Hove's Roman Tragedies, which is not an opera, but it's just the best thing I've seen in maybe my whole life. Really? So I keep talking about it. Oh my God. Yeah, it was incredible.
It's a play.
It was Ivo van Hove is a Dutch director who runs a group, and he brought them here to BAM to do three of Shakespeare's Roman tragedies back to back. So it was Coriolanus, followed by Julius Caesar, followed by Antony and Cleopatra in a row in Dutch, and everybody was invited up on the stage to eat and drink and live tweet from the stage, and the actors would struggle and fight, and there were times when furniture went down and you had to kind of run away from a scene because it was getting invaded by actors, and it was totally wild and unlike anything I've ever seen. And I'm waiting for somebody to do that with opera or an opera.
Wow. Sounds amazing.
Yeah, it was
incredible. That does sound amazing.
Someone could get their eye poked out.
Yeah, I saw his head a gobbler, and it was amazing. Oh, it was one of the best things I've ever seen. Definitely.
Yeah. Oh God, I would. Yeah, I want to see anything.
He had a scene with Elizabeth Marvel, who is a wonderful actress who actually happens to live in my building in Brooklyn. And there was a scene where this character came in and poured tomato soup just down her face. And it was just the creepiest thing I've ever seen. It was a really striking image, but it completely made sense. It wasn't a gratuitous image at all. It really fit in with the entire play and was an amazing moment. So
wow, right. Yeah, tomato. Yeah, food in the theater. Food being used as a thing. You know?
Yeah,
you're listening to the Indie Opera Podcast.
Opera Oggi presents Suor Angelica, March 21st at 7 p.m. and March 24th at 6 p.m. For more information, visit their website, operaogny.info.
Opera on Tap is pleased to present its first ever full production of an original opera, Smashed, The Carrie Nation Story, by composer James Barry and librettist Timothy Braun. Performances are April 4th through 6th at 7 p.m. at the Here Arts Center. For more information, go to operaontap.org.
VPR Opera presents Incontro Barocco with Opera Feroce and Friends. Saturday, April 6th and Sunday, April 7th at 8 p.m. For more information, visit vpropera.org.
Opera Mission presents the North American premiere of Handel's Rodrigo at the Gershwin Hotel, Tuesday, May 21st through Saturday, May 25th. For more information, check operamission.org.
Let's get into Elio Gabalo. Now am I saying it right?
Yes, yes.
Oh, there we go. The accent is on the ga.
Approved.
Approved.
So let's first start off with Cavalli. Now, just for those listeners who might not be familiar with Cavalli, can you tell us a little bit about Cavalli Mauro?
Yes. Well, Cavalli lived in the 17th century. So he Italian composer who mostly lived in Venice. So he probably was a student of Monteverdi, so it's the generation after Monteverdi. And he was, after Monteverdi, perhaps one of the most famous opera composers. So he composed about 30 operas, and some of them were performed all over Italy, like Il Giasone. And he also traveled to Paris in the 1660s. And for a couple of years, and his operas were performed there. He was a church musician. But he was also involved in producing opera, actually, at the beginning of his career. In that fabulous period, there was the beginnings of opera, public opera in Venice, where there were all these, a little bit like in New York now, all these small opera companies that, try to make it and were actually successful. And so he was part also of the, was really part of this world. So it's a very interesting figure, of course, mostly as composer. And his operas now are much more performed than, say, 30 years ago, 20 or 30 years ago. There's a real Cavalli revival now. Mm-hmm. And this is also thanks to small opera companies, like Gotham. And so this in a nutshell, is Cavalli. So he's really, let's say, a successor of Monteverdi. There are a lot of Elio Gabalo that reminds us of Popea, the coronation of Popea, mm-hmm. l'incoronazione di Popea, and also the fact that the protagonist is an emperor, and he goes after women, and the style too is very close to Monteverdi, in this opera. So it's great. Really a musical theater.
This is something, one of his last, or his last work?
His last surviving work.
And let's sort of give the audience a little bit of idea of what it means to try and put together a production of an opera that from that time period. Now, often the residue of what's left over from a Baroque opera is maybe a melody line sure. with a figured bass, which means just little numbers which say this is the harmonies that you hang from this note. And sometimes you don't even get the script. So how much was there of the Elio Gabalo for you to start working on?
Well, there is, as you said, the bass line, and there are also the parts of the violins, and the couple of violins, cello and violone. So it's a really a small orchestra, and it's they alternate the strings alternate with the voice. Sometimes they are together, but they mostly alternate, and you know, there are different theories about what to do with such a, you know, thin score, and there are those who add a lot of like wind instruments, and they like René Jacobs performed this opera in 2004, and the orchestra was really an 18th century orchestra, you know, like a Mozart orchestra. Huh. Instead, there are those like I think this production, like Grant Herald, who you know, there are much fewer instruments, and this is more faithful to what it used to be, because there was not much money to for these impresarios and for the theaters to hire musicians. So the orchestras were very, very small.
Was Cavalli was a wealthy man, right?
Well, not too much. I mean, he did well. He married well, and but he wasn't a noble. In fact, the name Cavalli is the name of his patron. Is not his real name. He was called Francesco Caletti, but when you adopted sometimes the name of your patron, who was always a nobleman. So yes, he did well. He did well. He was, but he wasn't a noble. Those who were doing really well, like the owners of the theater where the opera was performed, the Grimani, those were really wealthy. Yes.
Okay.
So Monteverdi wrote for, you know, extremely rich people, right? He had a court orchestra. He kind of had gigantic resources at his disposal, but this Cavalli. He had to compose for a smaller ensemble. Is that correct?
No, Monteverdi too wrote for, you know, Poppea was performing in the same theater that Elio Gabalo was performed. So you know, Poppea too, although we hear sometimes, you know, big orchestras doing it, it was written for a very small ensemble. So I mean, they had a performance in church, you know, they could hire for state functions, but for as far as theater was concerned, opera, no, they didn't have much money. They had to make a profit. So
yeah.
No big orchestra, only in courts, like, you know, in other cities in Europe. But in Italy, it was an impresario model. So it was small orchestras.
What would be the smallest grouping of forces that they could reasonably put one of these operas on with? Like how many? How many players?
Well, maybe 10, 12. You know, you can have a couple of violins, a cello, a violone, maybe two harpsichords, a theorbo, and you know, that was it. Really, it could be really the singer was the center of attention.
Right.
So it wasn't good to overshadow the singers.
And were singers making much greater fees than your average? Yeah, that's what I assumed. Yeah.
The singers were the real stars.
Yeah.
Of the system, so to obscure them would not have been good, and the public, the audience was there for the singers, not for
right.
the
right.
So
right,
how
right,
much
right,
of
right.
the how much of the score existed? Were there holes in it that you needed to fill in for this production, or did you have a complete from beginning to end?
No, it's complete.
Good.
So the issue is to cut it. Actually, that's what every performance has to do, not to go over 3 hours. And so it's complete because Cavalli although the opera was not performed, as you probably know, at that time, was canceled at the last minute. So this is a very interesting case. But Cavalli took care of preserving the score for posterity.
Go ahead. So it was canceled, but they ended up performing another composer's version of the same story at the same theater. Right.
Exactly. The librettist had to hastily rewrite the libretto, and another composer who was much younger than Cavalli, Cavalli was in his 60s, and this composer was 27 years old, was called from Rome, and the opera had the same subject, but ended with the repentance of the emperor.
Oh, hilarious. Hilarious, which never would have happened with this guy, ever.
Ever.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's what Peter was saying about honor, you know, all these values that today are so out of fashion, and, you know, it was a different society. So to have the emperor killed at the end, like in Cavalli's opera, was not considered good. So they changed the finale, and they moderated, they really toned down all the most subversive parts of the opera. So we can compare the two operas. It's a very interesting.
So there was no scenes where Iliogabalus starts a new religion and circumcises himself or anything like that, as is reported about his life.
Yeah,
that doesn't make it into the opera, yeah.
So tell us, what is the story then, James? What is the, tell us the sort of an overview of what is the opera about?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. The piece, as we understand the character and the figure historically versus what actually happens in the opera, is, there's some pretty significant differences there, obviously. But, you know, within the opera, it begins with an uprising of the soldiers who are basically attempting to overthrow Iliogabalo for basically not paying them. And so that's where it begins. But what's interesting about it is that Iliogabalo immediately forgives them, almost as an afterthought. I mean, almost in an extremely sort of fickle way. He says, "Oh yes, I'm going to pluck these phantoms from their minds and forgive it immediately, and that way it'll never happen again." And what we find very early on in the opera is kind of a focus on the idea of what oaths and vows mean between the various lovers, and essentially a society in which oaths and words don't mean anything is a society that is necessarily thrown into chaos. And you know, during his life, the emperor is reported to have had, you know, at least 5 wives, and that's during the 4 years in which he reigned, from the ages of 14 to 18. and so I think that the piece is very
But really, what would you do if you were a 16-year-old emperor? And it doesn't seem that crazy to me.
No, absolutely. I mean, also a world in which there are no consequences, essentially. Right. And when you believe that you are not just when you believe that you are God on earth, then you believe that you are supremely divined and ordained to essentially do whatever you want. And you know, he was also a priest of his religion, but I mean, it wasn't sort of in the same context of what we think of his religion being now, in terms of it being sexually restrictive or, you know, anything like that. Quite the contrary, it was
like
geared towards
King.
Yeah, absolutely, ecstatic rites, and, you know, figuring out, you know, the greatest extent of physical joys and pleasures possible. And you know, it's sort of to get a sense of it, the movie of Caligula actually gives one kind of a sense of what his life might have been like.
That is has to be one of the strangest films ever, just because of it being kind of half made and then taken over, and it just it's one of the weirdest things ever to be seen.
Yeah, I highly recommend it.
Yeah, definitely.
So when you were presented with this story and with the script, what were your first thoughts?
To be honest with you, I didn't respond to it the first time I read it too terribly well. But I always love a challenge, and so as with any piece, you know, you sit with it, you read it over and over again, you listen to the music, and I would say it really did grow on me, and in coming up with the staging and the blocking, it really kind of, it doesn't direct itself in the way that a Puccini opera might, but I found it, I found so many interesting layers of depth and meaning within it. Lots of innuendo, lots of subtext to play with. And fortunately, Gotham has given me just like the greatest cast. I mean, every single one of them is just top notch, and they're actors as well as singers, and they're the choices that they're making both dramatically and you know, I'm giving them ideas and then they're improving upon those ideas, and then I take those, and it's been a really wonderfully collaborative process thus far.
So I find that Baroque operas, they do take a while to get into because the storytelling isn't on the surface. I mean, you have to look at it. Obviously, this is a love song or this is
well
a
said.
Yeah, it's not on the surface. The
well story... said. That's exactly how. That's I agree. That's a good way of saying it.
You know, and you need to sort of delve into it to because their primary goal wasn't necessarily the storytelling itself.
Well, it's a different kind of storytelling. You're not telling like this long range story that everything kind of links up, or you're not building towards a kind of one peak. You're not, you know what I mean? It's kind of about just rhetoric and persuading the audience in a bunch of different ways, right? Maybe someone else can put me down for that one.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of recitative, and you know, it's a very talky opera in a sense, and I think that simultaneously provides opportunities to explore all the different ways in which those things can be meant and understood. So,
but for a modern audience, is it something you feel you need to become sort of a conduit for their engagement, or is it something that as a raw object is just put out there and sung that a modern audience can enjoy?
I think that there's a sense in which we're all aware of our responsibility to in making this material relevant to a modern audience. I mean, there's definitely a sense in which part of the reason we are digging so deep with it and being so sort of finely refined in terms of the attention to detail is because I really believe that if we weren't to be so detail oriented, the audience could very potentially, I mean, the audience could lose interest in the piece.
So, and I know that, I know you're doing something very special with this piece. And I know you haven't sort of spilled the beans, but tell us a little bit about where you're performing it and why you're performing it in that location.
Sure. I mean, Neil Gorin approached me with the piece about 4 years ago, actually. And we've talked for years about, you know, where we should perform it. At one point we were looking at Lincoln Center. At another point we were looking to do something in the direction of kind of like Sleep No More, and where it became sort of a place where different scenes happened in different locations and the audience might kind of travel around. And then at one point it became kind of a pop-up nightclub idea. And then ultimately we settled on the box. And, you know, part of the reason is that if Elio Gabalo were, you know, as a person could be turned into a space, essentially, whether it's a literal or a conceptual space, he would be the box, or he would be a performer at the box, he would attend the box, he'd be an owner of the box. And, you know, the type of programming that particular club tends to produce is, you know, a very specific kind of act, and I mean there's a wide range of activities that they.
All right, not everyone in the audience is going to know what the box is, so just tell us a little bit more about the venue when you say the box.
Yeah, I mean actually the space is down on the Lower East Side and in the sort of Bowery area, and
it's a club, right?
It's a night. Yeah, it's a club, and the acts that take place there sort of have to be seen to be believed. I attended some performances there and was forever altered. And
hopefully not physically.
No. I think that the kinds of acts that take place there definitely push everyone's boundaries and what they might be interested in or comfortable with and things like that. And that's part of the carnivalesque atmosphere that it kind of has. So, you know, the Elio Gabalo, who, you know, has on his resume, or at least allegations of child sacrifice, self-castration, prostituting himself in the temple. He, you know, offered money, vast sums of money, to any doctor who could equip him with female genitalia. Whoa. He was a man to every woman, a woman to every man. I mean, so where else should this piece be performed but at the Box? And, you know.
Are you going to have circus acts incorporated into the show, or...
Originally, we were looking at having a few sort of incorporated to the show, and we are using some of their aerial acts.
Wow.
Yeah, and so what I guess I would say is that we've created a style of programming that would be as appealing to Gotham's traditional audience as it would be to the Box's traditional audience. And you know, what I've been saying is that, you know, any kind of Baroque opera is every bit as much a fetish as an actual fetish. So
so it's sort of a Baroque burlesque. Is there a word?
Yeah, exactly. That's
burlesque.
Burlesque.
So, Jake, do you think Elio Gabalo was ahead of his time in any way, or do you think he was just a really primitive kind of mess, you know?
He was inspired, you know?
He was inspired?
He was inspired. I mean, he had a sort of personal imperative that he just willed upon the rest of society. And, you know, even if you're so sexually lascivious that you're even offending the Romans, like
you gotta go pretty far for that.
Exactly.
I'm from Rome.
Yeah.
Right. When in Rome. Yeah.
Let's tell the audience when this is happening. So when does the show open?
The show is opening on March 15th, and there are several other productions after that as well.
So it's playing March 15th through the 29th. And where should they go for more information?
GothamChamberOpera.org will have all of the details. And tickets are selling extremely quickly.
Let's talk about other aspects of the production. The orchestra and everything, what is the size of the orchestra you're going to use? And who's conducting?
We have... We have two theorbos, a violin, a cello, a harpsichord, and Grant Herod is conducting, and Neil Gorin is playing the harpsichord. And it's been a really amazing experience watching, you know, collaborating with them, with the cast. And my assistant director, Austin McCormick, is a very well-known choreographer as well in New York, and has done some great movement and dance pieces for this opera as well. We have a DJ who's coming in and to give it the club feel, like from the moment that the audience comes in. Wow. And on top of this, like, sort of very deviant, you know, club music that we worked on, he has Cavalli sort of layered on top of that, and so it's kind of an interesting mashup of sounds that will please and delight the senses from the moment you enter the theater.
And most importantly, can you drink during the show?
Absolutely.
There we go.
Sold.
I wouldn't have it any other way.
I have a question for you, James. I've directed Baroque material before. I actually worked with Grant Herod on Il Ballo delle Ingrate, by Monteverdi. And I wanted to know, because Baroque opera is so interesting in that often nothing really happens for long periods of time, and the melodies can be very repetitive, and you can get these long stretches of time where you kind of enter a different sense of time on stage. And I was wondering, do you feel like you need to fill all of that time with action on the stage, or do you prefer to kind of just let it just give into the simplicity of it and just have the audience kind of marvel at the beauty of the music? How do you approach that sense of time?
I mean, I come from a musical background as well. And so, I mean, there are definitely moments where I allow the audience to simply luxuriate in a given aria. I mean, you know, there are certain ones that I really just allow the music and trust in the performer to just, you know, approach that piece with tremendous vulnerability and really just stay out of the way of it. And then there are other moments where the action is quite filled and the music is quite filled, and you know, it's always a balance that mm-hmm. you I mean, especially with a new piece, I mean, one in which there's almost no production history to kind of draw from, and you know, and also working with a group of singers, most of whom I've never worked with before, and so you enter the room and you meet these people for the first time, and the journey begins. And I think that you'll find that there's a nice amount of contrast. I mean, every given piece, you know, probably doesn't resemble what happened just before it. And just kind of like dealing with what's in the moment at the time. And
so now this is considered the U.S. stage premiere of this?
Is this professional? Yeah, I think Aspen had done it a few years ago.
Yes.
The Aspen Music Festival.
And the version that you're performing, that Mauro curated, tell us just a little bit about the publication of this. So you're doing a critical edition for Baron-Reiter?
Right. There is
Sorry. You should explain it. It's your project. Oh, no. Sorry.
No. It's okay. It's a project of a complete edition of the operas of Cavalli. You know, as I said, there are 30 of them, so there are many, and one has been published. So it's just at the beginning, and so it's. But the opera was first performed in Crema, which is the birthplace of Cavalli in North Italy. And in 1999. So then in 2004, as I said, René Jacobs did it in Brussels at La Monnaie. And then, as James said, in Aspen in 2007. And then it sort of picked up the interest for this opera. There was a British production. There are some clips on YouTube of a production at Northington. I don't particularly like it, but it was performed in 2009. Then we did it at Stony Brook as a student performance, because we have a DMA program at Stony Brook. And Neil actually came, Neil Gorham, at this performance. And then last year was done in 2011 in Dortmund in Germany, using the edition, which is in press, but the parts are available, is already available from Baron-Reiter, and now Gotham is doing it in New York, and it's true, it's the first really professional premiere with these gorgeous singers who sings these gorgeous lament arias, yeah. Very much modeled on Monteverdi's, you know, Lamento della Ninfa, and Lamento d'Arianna. Yeah. So they also duet laments. They lament in couples. And when you have such wonderful voices as Gotham has, to have, you know, duets is such a sheer pleasure to listen, and I'm sure also to see, because, you know, I haven't seen a staged rehearsal, only a the beginning of the rehearsals. So
so now let's listen to a little bit. Thank you. So what stage are we at now in the rehearsal process? It opens next week.
We're in really good shape, actually. We had sketched all of Act One by the end of the first 3 days of rehearsal, and we finished up Act Two and continued reviewing One all last week. And basically, starting yesterday, we were just adding more and more details, more and more layers. And today, I mean, we're in great shape. The show's completely staged. The chorus is there. The dancers are there. Everything is integrated. And it's actually a really, really short tech process for us. We don't move into the theater until Monday. And then we have dress rehearsals on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, which is an invited dress. And then we open Friday. The singers do not have a dark day. Right. And it is going to be probably the fastest tech process I've ever been involved with.
Now, it sounds like a show that can sort of, especially with the subject matter, sort of spin out of control. Is there a place, has it gone anywhere that sort of surprised you? And have you ever had to say, all right, I think we've taken something too far?
Well, you know, that the part of that debate has to do with, again, mixing the Gotham audience with the box audience, you know. And there's definitely some humor in there that actually I have to turn away and sort of put my head down, and I just sort of begin convulsing with laughter. I can't even watch it. And, you know, I'm still, there are definitely moments where we've had to tone things down a little bit. But I still think that it's quite daring and bold in most of what it achieves. So I'm excited.
This is exciting. Brooke, you've been very quiet.
Been listening.
Oh.
No, I have a couple questions because I lived in Boston for a long time, and Boston is known as an early music town and in terms of historically informed performance and all that stuff. And as a singer, I'm curious about, I trust that Gotham is not necessarily hiring early music singers per se, although I looked at the cast list, I don't know any of those singers. But I wonder what, Mauro, what your thoughts are on that, like the sort of early music style of singing that is so popular in Boston.
Yes, I think singers, they seem to now navigate different centuries more easily than in the past. That is my impression in also being on a DMA program and having some contacts with students, you know, doctoral students. So you have singers who can sing, you know, 19th century opera, but are also at home with Handel and with Cavalli. Now, I don't know the particular singers actually that Gotham hired. I know that some of them were in Il Sogno di Scipione, which was another of their wonderful productions last year, directed by Christopher Alden. A couple of them were in that opera, in a Mozart opera. And I think it used to be that maybe singers were specializing a lot, you know, in Baroque opera, but it seems, as I said, that there is more flexibility.
It seems... Sorry, Brooke, did you have another question?
No.
It seems that it's interesting how the sort of new music scene and Baroque scene seem to join together so easily.
Yeah.
I think part of that has to do with the fact that the way we do Baroque opera now is so incredibly, it's such a unique thing. It's not historically based necessarily. Like, we're creating a whole new way of thinking about music by looking at it historically, but not trying to recreate something historically.
Absolutely.
That you're basically creating new opera, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I just find it very exciting that there's so much great Baroque stuff going on in the city, and it's all innovative and interesting, though it's probably absolutely nothing like what the original audiences saw.
Yeah. Right, on the other hand, Peter, to recreate as it was in the 17th century, it's almost impossible because we don't know enough. So I think you're perfectly right that it's good.
And
to
who
go.
Wants to?
Yeah.
Who wants it? No, I mean, I always think that's such a weird thing to do, to like, oh, we're going to get this exact...
Well, actually, Mauro.
Yes. What?
Mauro, I wanted to ask you if you saw the, was it Atis? It was at BAM?
Yeah.
Yes.
Did you
yes.
see that? What did you think of that? Was that, do you think that was an accurate representation of how it used to be performed?
that's exactly the issue that I was touching upon, that although, you know, they're, of course, wonderful in the, from the musical point of view, you know, William Christie, Lazare Florissant, and great right. singers. I object to the staging, which is, although it declares not to be historical, but in the end, when you have Lully on stage in the prologue, and it's hard to when you have all these wigs and all this historical. I much prefer stagings like La Didone that the Wüstel Group did a few years ago by Cavalli again.
Right.
And mm-hmm. that was a very creative staging. With the, was mixed with a sci-fi movie from the 1960s, and it was also historical. There were, you know, there was accuracy in the style of singing. Hai Tin Chin was one of the singers who was also in contemporary opera. Fantastic. So yeah.
Yeah, she's like, I think we mention her on every show.
Yeah, oh, okay. we like Hai Tin.
right. And you know, she was in the Philip Glass opera in Bob Wilson, and so yeah. as you said, Peter, this bridge between the 17th century and the 21st century is very productive. Is very productive for so yes, my preference is for modern stagings and not right. recreations.
Well, Atis is sort of a special situation, because in some ways, now I could be so wrong, but when they first performed Atis, it was kind of revolutionary, because it was it's bringing this historicism that hadn't been brought to it previously. Yes. I saw the Atis when they did it at BAM, and it really did feel like a museum piece. It was kind of dead to me. But I think if I hadn't known anything about Baroque opera, I might have been a little more excited about it. I just, when I saw it, it felt sort of museum-y, you know? So I think Atis sort of stands out a little, just in that when they first performed Atis, it was kind of a new, I just think it's a problem to think that you're actually going to recreate anything historically. But there are people who, that's so important to them. Oh, what would the harpsichord sound like?
Yeah, I mean, there's just the performance of Macbeth where they did it with the original way of like, supposedly the way they spoke it in Shakespeare's time, really? Which I don't know how they did that, but yeah.
I just think that makes directing and storytelling and however you're related to the process of making theater work, it makes it into a kind of game. And it is a game, but it's a kind of more holy game than just kind of trying to figure out what was done. You know, I just think it reminds me of this really like low level English course I took in undergrad where we read the Return of Martin Guerre, you know, and it was an okay book, but the professor was just fascinated with, well, do we know, can we figure out if Martin Guerre really was the man who he said he was? And the answer is, these are like 14th century peasants who were illiterate. And no, we can't figure it out. And it's not a whodunit. And who cares? It might be interesting for other reasons, but when we don't have information, it's like playing detective is really, seems to me, a very boring game.
Yeah. Well, you know, I probably said this on the podcast before. I'm going to say it again. I just think it's funny that now when we recreate a harpsichord sound and they're trying to make it for, let's say, an electronic piano, they sit there and they try and put in the little squeak and the little click. But when they were originally making the harpsichord, they worked really hard so that it wouldn't squeak and click. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so that the intention was the exact opposite. And now to be original, we somehow have to put the bad stuff back in. I don't know. Anyway,
I mean, what would be great if you put, you know, Cavalli or Monteverdi or Mozart in front of a computer, you know, and said, look, make whatever sounds you want. Let's see what you could do, you know, and then we would find out what they really wanted to hear. But we'll never be able to do that.
Maybe. I don't know. Or is it the imposition of a musical style that was already in place that caused them to kind of create things in the first place? What if we put Mozart in front of a computer and gave him all the possibilities and he just blinked? You know what I'm saying? Like, we have no idea the relationship between musical materials and the ways that we produce things. I think it's always going to be a mystery.
Yeah.
But let me also say that since I did a critical edition, it is important to know the point of departure. So what was done, and I think, you know, all the the performance of the directors, you know, including the Wooster Group, when they did La Didone, they did a very thorough study of the period, you know, what was done. But then, you know, then when you do things, then it's a different matter. You do it in a contemporary way. So the both things can go together. They're not, you know, they cannot. But as Peter said, to follow blindly what we think we know and we don't about the period could be really a dead end in stagings.
Excellent. Excellent people. Excellent discussion. This is terrible.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much, James. Thank you so much, Mauro. This has been a great discussion, and I would like to thank the audience for listening, and I'd like to thank Brooke and Noah and Walker.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Have a great night. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Got Stitcher? We are on it, so get it. Stitcher is an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.